"In here, Slayer," growled the man in the doorway. "And you, Sphinx, now."
"Sam," said Alaris, "this is Archmaester Marwyn." Marwyn wore a chain of many metals around his bull's neck. Save for that, he looked more like a dockside thug than a maester. His head was too big for his body, and the way it thrust forward from his shoulders, together with that slab of a jaw, made him look as if he were about to tear off someone's head. Though short and squat, he was heavy in the chest and shoulders, with a round, rock-hard ale belly straining at the laces of the leather jerkin he wore in place of robes. Bristly white hair sprouted from his ears and nostrils. His brow beetled, his nose had been broken more than once, and sourleaf had stained his teeth a mottled red. He had the biggest hands that Sam had ever seen. When Sam hesitated, one of those hands grabbed him by the arm and yanked him through the door. The room beyond was large and round. Books and scrolls were everywhere, strewn across the tables and stacked up on the floor in piles 4 feet high. Faded tapestries and ragged maps covered the stone walls. A fire was burning in the hearth beneath a copper kettle. Whatever was inside of it smelled burnt. Aside from that, the only light came from a tall black candle in the center of the room. The candle was unpleasantly bright. There was something queer about it. The flame did not flicker, even when Archmaester Marwyn closed the door so hard that papers blew off a nearby table. The light did something strange to colors, too. Whites were bright as fresh fallen snow, yellow shone like gold, reds turned to flame, but the shadows were so black they looked like holes in the world. Sam found himself staring. The candle itself was 3 feet tall and slender as a sword, ridged and twisted, glittering black. "Is that obsidian?" said the other man in the room, a pale, fleshy, pasty-faced young fellow with round shoulders, soft hands, close-set eyes, and food stains on his robes. "Call it dragon glass." Archmaester Marwyn glanced at the candle for a moment. "It burns, but is not consumed."
"What feeds the flame?" asked Sam.
"What feeds a dragon's fire?" Marwyn seated himself upon a stool. All Valyrian sorcery was rooted in blood or fire. The sorcerers of the Freehold could see across mountains, seas, and deserts with one of these glass candles. They could enter a man's dreams and give him visions and speak to one another, half a world apart, seated before their candles. Do you think that might be useful, Slayer?
We would have no more need of ravens.
Only after battles.
The Archmaester peeled a sour leaf off a bale, shoved it in his mouth, and began to chew it.
Tell me all you told our Dornish Sphinx. I know much of it and more, but some small parts may have escaped my notice.
He was not a man to be refused. Sam hesitated a moment, then told his tale again as Marwyn, Alaras, and the other novice listened. Maester Aemon believed that Daenerys Targaryen was the fulfillment of a prophecy. Her! Not Stannis, nor Prince Rhaegar, nor the princeling whose head was dashed against the wall.
Born amidst salt and smoke, beneath a bleeding star. I know the prophecy.
Marwyn turned his head and spat a gob of red phlegm onto the floor. Not that I would trust it.
Gorgon of old Gis once wrote that a prophecy is like a treacherous woman. She takes your member in her mouth, and you moan with the pleasure of it and think, how sweet, how fine, how good this is. And then her teeth snap shut, and your moans turn to screams. That is the nature of prophecy, said Gorgon. Prophecy will bite your prick off every time.
He chewed a bit.
Still.
Alaris stepped up next to Sam. Aemon would have gone to her if he had the strength. He wanted us to send a maester to her, to counsel her and protect her and fetch her safely home.
Did he? Archmaester Marwyn shrugged. Perhaps it's good that he died before he got to Old Town. Elsewise the grey sheep might have had to kill him, and that would have made the poor old dears wring their wrinkled hands.
Kill him? Sam said, shocked. Why?
If I tell you, they may need to kill you too.
Marwyn smiled a ghastly smile, the juice of the sour leaf running red between his teeth.
Who do you think killed all the dragons the last time around?
Gallant dragon slayers armed with swords? He spat. The world the Citadel is building has no place in it for sorcery or prophecy or glass candles, much less for dragons. Ask yourself why Aemon Targaryen was allowed to waste his life upon the wall, when by rights he should have been raised to Archmaester. His blood was why. He could not be trusted, no more than I can.
What will you do?
Asked Alarus the Sphinx. Get myself to Slaver's Bay in Aemon's place. The swan ship that delivered Slayer should serve my needs well enough. The grey sheep will send their man on a galley, I don't doubt. With fair winds I should reach her first. Marwyn glanced at Sam again and frowned. You should stay and forge your chain. If I were you, I would do it quickly. A time will come when you'll be needed on the wall. He turned to the pasty-faced novice. Find Slayer a dry cell. He'll sleep here and help you tend the ravens.
But, Sam sputtered, the other archmaesters, the Seneschal, what should I tell them?
Tell them how wise and good they are. Tell them that Aemon commanded you to put yourself into their hands. Tell them that you have always dreamed that one day you might be allowed to wear the chain and serve the greater good, that service is the highest honor and obedience the highest virtue. But say nothing of prophecies or dragons, unless you fancy poison in your porridge. Marwyn snatched a stained leather cloak off a peg near the door and tied it tight. Sphinx, look after this one.
I will,
Alarus answered, but the Archmaester was already gone. They heard his boots stomping down the steps.
Where has he gone?
Asked Sam, bewildered.
To the docks. The mage is not a man who believes in wasting time.
Alarus smiled. I have a confession. Ours was no chance encounter, Sam. The mage sent me to snatch you up before you spoke to Tybalt. He knew that you were coming.
How?
Alarus nodded at the glass candle. Sam stared at the strange, pale flame for a moment, then blinked and looked away. Outside the window, it was growing dark.
There's an empty sleeping cell under mine in the West Tower, with steps that lead right up to Walgrave's chambers, said the pasty-faced youth. If you don't mind the ravens quawking, there's a good view of the honey wine.
Would that serve?
I suppose. He had to sleep somewhere.
I will bring you some woolen coverlets. Stone walls turn cold at nights, even here.
My thanks.
There was something about the pale, soft youth that he misliked, but he did not want to seem discourteous, so he added, My name's not Slayer, truly. I'm Sam. Samwell Tarly.
I'm Pate, the other said, like the pig boy.
The Blind Girl. Her nights were lit by distant stars and the shimmer of moonlight on snow, but every dawn she woke to darkness. She opened her eyes and stared up blind at the black that shrouded her, her dream already fading. So beautiful. She licked her lips, remembering the bleating of the sheep, the terror in the shepherd's eyes, the sound the dogs had made as she killed them one by one, the snarling of her pack. Game had become scarcer since the snows began to fall, but last night they had feasted. Lamb and dog and mutton and the flesh of man. Some of her little grey cousins were afraid of men, even dead men, but not her. Meat was meat, and men were prey. She was the night wolf, but only when she dreamed. The blind girl rolled onto her side, sat up, sprang to her feet, stretched. Her bed was a rag-stuffed mattress on a shelf of cold stone, and she was always stiff and tight when she awakened. She padded to her basin on small, bare, calloused feet, silent as a shadow, splashed cool water on her face, patted herself dry.
Sir Gregor, she thought, Dunson, Raff the Sweetling, Sir Ilan, Sir Merrin, Queen Cersei, her morning prayer. Or was it? No, she thought, not mine. I am no one. That is the night wolf's prayer. Some day she will find them, hunt them, smell their fear, taste their blood. Some day.
She found her small clothes in a pile, sniffed at them to make sure they were fresh enough to wear, donned them in her darkness. Her servant's garb was where she'd hung it, a long tunic of undyed wool, rough spun and scratchy. She snapped it out and pulled it down over her head with one smooth, practiced motion. Socks came last, one black, one white. The black one had stitching round the top, the white none. She could feel which was which, make sure she got each sock on the right leg. Skinny as they were, her legs were strong and springy and growing longer every day. She was glad of that. A water dancer needs good legs. Blind Beth was no water dancer, but she would not be Beth forever. She knew the way to the kitchens, but her nose would have led her there, even if she hadn't. Hot peppers and fried fish, she decided, sniffing down the hall. And bread fresh from Uma's oven. The smells made her belly rumble. The night wolf had feasted, but that would not fill the blind girl's belly. Dream meat could not nourish her. She had learned that early on. She broke her fast on sardines, fried crisp in pepper oil, and served so hot they burned her fingers. She mopped up the leftover oil with a chunk of bread torn off the end of Uma's morning loaf and washed it all down with a cup of watered wine, savouring the tastes and the smells, the rough feel of the crust beneath her fingers, the slickness of the oil, the sting of the hot pepper when it got into the half-heel scrape on the back of the hand. Hear, smell, taste, feel, she reminded herself. There are many ways to know the world for those who cannot see. Someone had entered the room behind her, moving on soft padded slippers, quiet as a mouse. Her nostrils flared. The kindly man. Men had a different smell than women, and there was a hint of orange in the air as well. The priest was fond of chewing orange rinds to sweeten his breath whenever he could get them.
"And who are you this morning?"
she heard him ask as he took his seat at the head of the table. "Tap, tap," she heard, then a tiny cracking sound, breaking his first egg.
"No one," she replied. "A lie. I know you. You are that blind beggar girl."
"Beth." She had known a Beth once back at Winterfell when she was Arya Stark. Maybe that was why she'd picked the name. Or maybe it was just because it went so well with blind.
"Poor child," said the kindly man, "would you like to have your eyes back? Ask, and you shall see."
He asked the same question every morning. "I may want them on the morrow, not today." Her face was still water, hiding all, revealing nothing.
"As you will."
She could hear him peeling the egg, and then a faint silvery clink as he picked up the salt spoon. He liked his eggs well salted.
"Where did my poor blind girl go begging last night?"
"The Inn of the Green Eel."
"And what three new things do you know that you did not know when last you left us?"
"The Sea Lord is still sick."
"This is no new thing. The Sea Lord was sick yesterday, and he will still be sick upon the morrow."
"Or dead?"
"When he is dead, that will be a new thing."
"When he is dead, there will be a choosing, and the knives will come out." That was the way of it in Braavos. In Westeros, a dead king was followed by his elder son, but the Braavosi had no kings.
"Tomo Frekar will be the new Sea Lord. Is that what they are saying at the Inn of the Green Eel?" "Yes."
The kindly man took a bite of his egg. The girl heard him chewing. He never spoke with his mouth full. He swallowed and said,
"Some men say there is wisdom in wine. Such men are fools. At other inns, other names are being bruited about, never doubt.
He took another bite of egg, chewed, swallowed.
What three new things do you know that you did not know before? I know that some men are saying that Tormo Fraker will surely be the new Sea Lord,
she answered.
Some drunken men?
Better. And what else do you know?
It is snowing in the Riverlands in Westeros,
she almost said. But he would have asked her how she knew that, and she did not think that he would like her answer. She chewed her lip, thinking back to last night.
The horse of Rhone is with child. She is not certain of the father, but thinks it might have been that Tyroshe sellsword that she killed.
This is good to know.
What else? The Merlin Queen has chosen a new mermaid to take the place of the one that drowned. She is the daughter of a Prestane serving maid, 13 and penniless, but lovely.
So are they all, at the beginning, said the priest. But you cannot know that she is lovely unless you've seen her with your own eyes. And you have none. Who are you, child?
No one.
Blind Beth, the beggar girl, is who I see. She is a wretched liar, that one. See to your duties. Valar Morghulis.
Valar Doherys.
She gathered up her bowl and cup, knife and spoon, and pushed to her feet. Last of all, she grasped her stick. It was 5 feet long, slender and supple, thick as her thumb, with leather wrapped around the shaft, a foot from the top.
Better than eyes, once you learn how to use it,
the waif had told her. That was a lie. They often lied to her, to test her. No stick was better than a pair of eyes. It was good to have, though, so she always kept it close. Uma had taken to calling her Stick, but names did not matter. She was her.
No one. I am no one. Just a blind girl. Just a servant of him of many faces.
Each night at supper, the waif brought her a cup of milk and told her to drink it down. The drink had a queer, bitter taste that the blind girl soon learned to loathe. Even the faint smell that warned her what it was before it touched her tongue soon made her feel like retching. But she drained the cup all the same.
How long must I be blind?
She would ask.
Until darkness is as sweet to you as light,
the waif would say.
Or until you ask us for your eyes, ask and you shall see. And then you'll send me away.
Better blind than that. They would not make her yield. On the day she had woken blind, the waif took her by the hand and led her through the vaults and tunnels of the rock on which the house of black and white was built, up the steep stone steps into the temple proper.
Count the steps as you climb, she had said. Let your fingers brush the wall. There are markings there, invisible to the eye, plain to the touch.
That was her first lesson. There had been many more. Poisons and potions were for the afternoons. She had smell and touch and taste to help her, but touch and taste could be perilous when grinding poisons. And with some of the waif's more toxic concoctions, even smell was less than safe. Burned pinky tips and blistered lips became familiar to her, and once she made herself so sick she could not keep down any food for days. Supper was for language lessons. The blind girl understood Bravasi and could speak it passably. She had even lost most of her barbaric accent, but the kindly man was not content. He was insisting that she improve her high Valyrian and learn the tongues of Lyce and Pentos too. In the evening, she played the lying game with a waif, but without eyes to see, the game was very different. Sometimes all she had to go on was tone and choice of words. Other times, the waif allowed her to lay hands upon her face. At first, the game was much, much harder, the next thing to impossible. But just when she was near the point of screaming with frustration, it all became much easier.
She learned to hear the lies, to feel them in the play of the muscles around the mouth and eyes. Many of her other duties had remained the same, but as she went about them, she stumbled over furnishings, walked into walls, dropped trays, got hopelessly, helplessly lost inside the temple. Once she almost fell headlong down the steps, but Sirio Farrell had taught her balance in another lifetime when she was a girl called Aria, and somehow she recovered and caught herself in time. Some night she might have cried herself to sleep if she had still been Ari or Weasel or Cat or even Aria of House Stark. But no one had no tears. Without eyes, even the simplest task was perilous. She burned herself a dozen times as she worked with Uma in the kitchens. Once, chopping onions, she cut her finger down to the bone. Twice she could not even find her own room in the cellar, and had to sleep on the floor at the base of the steps. All the nooks and alcoves made the temple treacherous, even after the blind girl had learned to use her ears. The way her footsteps bounced off the ceiling and echoed round the legs of the 30 tall stone guards made the walls themselves seem to move, and the pool of still black water did strange things to sound as well.
You have 5 senses, the kindly man said. Learn to use the other 4. You will have fewer cuts and scrapes and scabs.
She could feel air currents on her skin now. She could find the kitchens by their smell, tell men from women by their scents. She knew Uma and the servants and the acolytes by the pattern of their footfalls, could tell one from the other before they got close enough to smell. But not the waif or the kindly man, who hardly made a sound at all, unless they wanted to. The candles burning in the temple had scents as well. Even the unscented ones gave off faint wisps of smoke from their wicks. They had as well been shouting once she had learned to use her nose. The dead men had their own smell too. One of her duties was to find them in the temple every morning, wherever they had chosen to lie down and close their eyes after drinking from the pool. This morning she found 2. One man had died at the feet of the stranger, a single candle flickering above him. She could feel its heat, and the scent that it gave off tickled her nose. The candle burned with a dark red flame, she knew. For those with eyes, the corpse would have seemed awash in a ruddy glow. Before summoning the servant men to carry him away, she knelt and felt his face, tracing the line of his jaw, brushing her fingers across his cheeks and nose, touching his hair.
Curly hair and thick, a handsome face, unlined. He was young.
She wondered what had brought him here, to seek the gift of death. Dying brothers oft found their way to the house of black and white, to hasten their ends, but this man had no wounds that she could find. The second body was that of an old woman. She had gone to sleep upon a dreaming couch in one of the hidden alcoves where special candles conjured visions of things loved and lost.
A sweet death and a gentle one,
the kindly man was fond of saying. Her fingers told her that the old woman had died with a smile on her face. She had not been dead long. Her body was still warm to the touch.
Her skin is so soft, like old thin leather that's been folded and wrinkled 1,000 times.
When the serving man arrived to bear the corpse away, the blind girl followed them. She let their footsteps be her guide, but when they made their descent, she counted. She knew the counts of all the steps by heart. Under the temple was a maze of vaults and tunnels, where even men with 2 good eyes were often lost. But the blind girl had learned every inch of it, and she had her stick to help her find her way should her memory falter. The corpses were laid out in the vault. The blind girl went to work in the dark, stripping the dead of boots and clothes and other possessions, emptying their purses and counting out their coins, telling one coin from another by touch alone, was one of the first things the waif had taught her after they took away her eyes. The Bravasi coins were old friends. She need only brush her fingertips across their faces to recognize them. Coins from other lands and cities were harder, especially those from far away. Valentine honors were most common. Little coins, no bigger than a penny, with a crown on one side and a skull on the other. Lycine coins were oval and showed a naked woman. Other coins had ships stamped onto them, or elephants, or goats. The Westerosi coins showed a king's head on the front and a dragon on the back. The old woman had no purse, no wealth at all, but for a ring on one thin finger. On the handsome man she found four golden dragons out of Westeros. She was running the ball of her thumb across the most worn of them, trying to decide which king it showed, when she heard a door opening softly behind her. "Who is there?" she asked.
"No one."
The voice was deep, harsh, cold, and moving. She stepped to one side, grabbed for her stick, snapped it up to protect her face. Wood clacked against wood. The force of the blow almost knocked the stick from her hand. She held on, slashed back, and found only empty air where he should have been.
"Not there," the voice said. "Are you blind?"
She did not answer. Talking would only muddle any sounds he might be making. He would be moving, she knew. Left or right? She jumped left, swung right, hit nothing. A stinging cut from behind her caught her in the back of the legs.
"Are you deaf?"
She spun, the stick in her left hand, whirling, missing. From the left, she heard the sound of laughter. She slashed right. This time she connected. Her stick smacked off his own. The impact sent a jolt up her arm.
"Good,"
the voice said. The blind girl did not know who the voice belonged to. One of the acolytes, she supposed. She did not remember ever hearing his voice before. But what was there to say that the servants of the many-faced god could not change their voices as easily as they did their faces? Besides her, the House of Black and White was home to two serving men, three acolytes, Uma the cook, and the two priests, whom she called the waif and the kindly man. Others came and went, sometimes by secret ways, but those were the only ones who lived here. Her nemesis could be any of them. The girl darted sideways, her stick spinning, heard a sound behind her, whirled in that direction, struck at air. And all at once his own stick was between her legs, tangling them as she tried to turn again, scraping down her shin. She stumbled and went down to one knee, so hard she bit her tongue. There she stopped.
"Still a stone. Where is he?"
Behind her, he laughed. He wrapped her smartly on one ear, then cracked her knuckles as she was scrambling to her feet. Her stick fell clattering to the stone. She hissed in fury.
"Go on, pick it up. I'm done beating you for today."
"No one beat me."
The girl crawled on all fours, then sprang back to her feet, bruised and dirty. The vault was still and silent. He was gone. Or was he? He could be standing right beside her. She would never know.
"Listen for his breathing," she told herself.
But there was nothing. She gave it another moment, then put her stick aside and resumed her work.
"If I had my eyes, I could beat him bloody."
One day the kindly man would give them back, and she would show them all. The old woman's corpse was cool by now, the bravo's body stiffening. The girl was used to that. Most days she spent more time with the dead than with the living. She missed the friend she'd had when she was cat of the canals, old Brusco with his bad back, his daughters Talia and Bria, the mummers from the ship, Mary and her whores at the happy port, all the other rogues and wharf-side scum. She missed Cat herself the most of all, even more than she missed her eyes. She had liked being Cat, more than she had ever liked being Salty or Squab or Weasel or Arry.
"I killed Cat when I killed that singer,"
The kindly man had told her that they would have taken her eyes from her anyway, to help her to learn to use her other senses, but not for half a year. Blind acolytes were common in the House of Black and White, but few as young as she. The girl was not sorry, though. Darien had been a deserter from the Night's Watch. He had deserved to die. She had said as much to the kindly man.
"And you are a god to decide who should live and who should die?" he asked her. "We give the gift to those marked by him of many faces, after prayers and sacrifice. So it has always been from the beginning. I have told you of the founding of our order, of how the first of us answer the prayers of slaves who wish for death. The gift was given only to those who yearned for it in the beginning. But one day the first of us heard a slave praying not for his own death, but for his master's. So fervently did he desire this that he offered all he had, that his prayer might be answered. And it seemed to our first brother that this sacrifice would be pleasing to him of many faces. So that night he granted the prayer. Then he went to the slave and said, 'You offered all you had for this man's death. But slaves have nothing but their lives. That is what the god desires of you. For the rest of your days on earth, you will serve him.' And from that moment, we were two." His hand closed around her arm, gently but firmly. "All men must die. We are but death's instruments, not death itself. When you slew the singer, you took God's powers on yourself. We kill men, but we do not presume to judge them. Do you understand?" "No," she thought. "Yes," she said. "You lie, and that is why you must now walk in darkness until you see the way. Unless you wish to leave us, you need only ask, and you may have your eyes back." "No," she thought. "No," she said. That evening after supper, and a short session of the lying game, the blind girl tied a strip of rag around her head to hide her useless eyes, found her begging bowl, and asked the waif to help her don Beth's face. The waif had shaved her head for her when they took her eyes, a mummer's cut, she called it, since many mummers did the same so their wigs might fit them better. But it worked for beggars too, and helped to keep their heads free from fleas and lice. More than a wig was needed, though. "I could cover you with weeping sores," the waif said, "but then innkeepers and taverners would chase you from their doors."
Instead, she gave her pox scars and a mummer's mole on one cheek with a dark hair growing from it.
"Is it ugly?"
the blind girl asked.
"It's not pretty."
"Good." She had never cared if she was pretty, even when she was stupid Arya Stark. Only her father had ever called her that. Him and Jon Snow, sometimes. Her mother used to say she could be pretty if she would just wash and brush her hair and take more care with her dress, the way her sister did. To her sister and sister's friends and all the rest, she had just been Arya Horseface. But they were all dead now, even Arya, everyone but her half-brother John. Some nights she heard talk of him in the taverns and brothels of the Ragman's Harbour. "The black bastard of the wall," one man had called him.
"Even John would never know blind Beth, I bet."
That made her sad. The clothes she wore were rags, faded and fraying, but warm, clean rags for all that. Under them she hid three knives, one in a boot, one up a sleeve, one sheathed at the small of her back. Bravassi were a kindly folk, by and large, more like to help the poor blind beggar girl than try to do her harm. But there were always a few bad ones who might see her as someone they could safely rob or rape. The blades were for them, though so far the blind girl had not been forced to use them. A cracked wooden begging bowl and belt of hempen rope completed her garb. She set out as the Titan roared the sunset, cunning her way down the steps from the temple door, then tapping to the bridge that took her over the canal to the Isle of the Gods. She could tell that the fog was thick from the clammy way her clothes clung to her and the damp feeling of the air on her bare hands. The Mists of Bravos did queer things to sounds as well, she had found.
Half the city will be half blind tonight.
As she made her way past the temples, she could hear the acolytes of the cult of Starry Wisdom atop their scrying tower singing to the evening stars. A wisp of scented smoke hung in the air, drawing her down the winding path to where the red priests had fired the great iron braziers outside the house of the Lord of Light. Soon she could even feel the heat in the air, as Red Relore's worshippers lifted their voices in prayer. "For the night is dark and full of terrors," they prayed.
"Not for me."
Her nights were bathed in moonlight and filled with the songs of her pack, with the taste of red meat torn off the bone, with the warm familiar smells of her grey cousins. Only during the days was she alone and blind. She was no stranger to the waterfront. Cat used to prowl the wharfs and alleys of the Ragman's Harbour, selling mussels and oysters and clams for Brusco. With her rag and her shaved head and her mama's mole, she did not look the same as she had then. But just to be safe, she stayed away from the ship and the happy port and the other places where Cat had been best known. She knew each inn and tavern by its scent. The Black Bargeman had a briny smell. Pinto stank of sour wine, stinky cheese, and Pinto himself, who never changed his clothes or washed his hair. At the sailmender's, the smoky air was always spiced with the scent of roasting meat. The House of Seven Lamps was fragrant with incense. The Satin Palace with the perfumes of pretty young girls who dreamed of being courtesans. Each place had its own sounds, too. Morago's and the Inn of the Green Eel had singers performing most nights. At the Outcast Inn, the patrons themselves did the singing, in drunken voices and half a hundred tongues. The Foghouse was always crowded with polemen off the serpent boats, arguing about guards and courtesans and whether or not the Sea Lord was a fool. The Satin Palace was much quieter, a place of whispered endearments, the soft rustle of silk gowns, and the giggling of girls. Beth did her begging at a different place every night. She had learned early on that innkeepers and taverners were more apt to tolerate her presence if it was not a frequent occurrence. Last night she had spent outside the Inn of the Green Eel, so tonight she turned right instead of left after the bloody bridge and made her way to Pinto's, at the other end of the Ragman's Harbour, right on the edge of the drowned town. Loud and smelly he might be, but Pinto had a soft heart under all his unwashed clothes and bluster. Oft as not, he would let her come inside, where it was warm, if the place was not too crowded, and now and again he might even let her have a mug of ale and a crust of food, whilst regaling her with his stories. In his younger days, Pinto had been the most notorious pirate in the Stepstones, to hear him tell it. He loved nothing better than to speak at great length about his exploits. She was in luck tonight. The tavern was near empty, and she was able to claim a quiet corner not far from the fire. No sooner had she settled there and crossed her legs when something brushed up against her thigh.
"You again," said the blind girl.
She scratched his head behind one ear, and the cat jumped up into her lap and began to purr. Bravos was full of cats, and no place more than Pinto's. The old pirate believed they brought good luck and kept his tavern free of vermin.
"You know me, don't you?" she whispered.
Cats were not fooled by Mama's moles. They remembered Cat of the Canals. It was a good night for the blind girl. Pinto was in a jolly mood,
and gave her a cup of watered wine, a chunk of stinky cheese, and half of an eel pie.
"Pinto is a very good man,"
he announced, then settled down to tell her of the time he seized the spice ship, a tale she had heard a dozen times before. As the hours passed, the tavern filled. Pinto was soon too busy to pay her any mind, but several of his regulars dropped coins into her begging bowl. Other tables were occupied by strangers, Ebenese whalers, who reeked of blood and blubber, a pair of bravas with scented oil in their hair, a fat man out of Lorith, who complained that Pinto's booths were too small for his belly, and later three Lyseni, sailors of the Good Heart, a storm-wracked galley that had limped into Bravos last night and been seized this morning by the Sea Lord's guards. The Lyseni took the table nearest to the fire and spoke quietly over cups of black tar rum, keeping their voices low so no one could overhear. But she was no one, and she heard most every word. And for a time it seemed that she could see them too, through the slitted yellow eyes of the tomcat purring in her lap. One was old and one was young, and one had lost an ear, but all three had the white blonde hair and smooth fair skin of Lyse, where the blood of the old freehold still ran strong. The next morning, when the kindly man asked her what three things she knew that she had not known before, she was ready.
"I know why the Sea Lord seized the Good Heart. She was carrying slaves, hundreds of slaves, women and children, roped together in her hold."
Bravos had been founded by escaped slaves, and the slave trade was forbidden here.
"I know where the slaves came from. They were wildlings from Westeros, from a place called Hard Home, an old ruined place, accursed."
Old Nairn had told her tales of Hard Home back at Winterfell when she had still been Arya Stark.
"After the big battle, where the king beyond the wall was killed, the wildlings ran away, and this woods witch said if they went to Hard Home, ships would come and carry them away to some place warm. But no ships came, except those two Lyseni pirates, Goodheart and Elephant, that had been driven north by the storm. They dropped anchor off Hard Home to make repairs and saw the wildlings. But there were thousands, and they didn't have room for all of them, so they said they'd just take the women and the children. The wildlings have nothing to eat, so the men sent out their wives and daughters, but as soon as the ships were out to sea, the Lyseni drove them below and roped them up. They meant to sell them all in Lyse. Only then they ran into another storm, and the ships were parted. The Goodheart was so damaged, her captain had no choice but to put in here. But the Elephant may have made it back to Lyse. The Lyseni at Pinto's think that she'll return with more ships. The price of slaves is rising, they said, and there are thousands more women and children at Hard Home. It is good to know. This is two. Is there a third? Yes. I know that you're the one who's been hitting me.
Her stick flashed out and cracked against his fingers, sending his own stick clattering to the floor. The priest winced and snatched his hand back.
And how could a blind girl know that?
I saw you.
I gave you three. I don't need to give you four.
Maybe on the morrow she would tell him about the cat that had followed her home last night from Pinto's, the cat that was hiding in the rafters looking down on them. Or maybe not. If he could have secrets, so could she. That evening, Uma served salt-crusted crabs for supper. When her cup was presented to her, the blind girl wrinkled her nose and drank it down in three long gulps. Then she gasped and dropped the cup. Her tongue was on fire, and when she gulped a cup of wine, the flames spread down her throat and up her nose.
"Wine will not help, and water will just fan the flames," the waif told her. "Eat this."
A heel of bread was pressed into her hand. The girl stuffed it in her mouth, chewed, swallowed.
It helped. A second chunk helped more. And come the morning, when the night wolf left her, and she opened her eyes, she saw that a tallow candle was burning where no candle had been the night before, its uncertain flame swaying back and forth like a whore at the happy port. She had never seen anything so beautiful. A ghost in Winterfell. The dead man was found at the base of the inner wall, with his neck broken and only his left leg showing above the snow that had buried him during the night. If Ramsay's bitches had not dug him up, he might have stayed buried till spring. By the time Ben Bones pulled them off, Grey Jane had eaten so much of the dead man's face that half the day was gone before they knew for certain who he'd been. A man-at-arms of 44 years who had marched north with Roger Risewell. A drunk, Risewell declared. Pissing off the wall, I'll wager. He slipped and fell. No one disagreed. But Theon Greyjoy found himself wondering why any man would climb the snow-slick steps to the battlements in the black of night just to take a piss. As the garrison broke its fast that morning on stale bread fried in bacon grease, the lords and knights ate the bacon. The talk along the benches was of little but the corpse. "Stannis has friends inside the castle," Theon heard one sergeant mutter. He was an old tall heart man, three trees sewn on his ragged surcoat. The watch had just changed. Men were coming in from the cold, stumping their feet to knock the snow off their boots and breeches as the midday meal was served. Blood sausage, leeks, and brown bread still warm from the ovens. "Stannis," laughed one of Roose Risewell's riders. "Stannis is snowed to death by now, else he's run back to the wall with his tail froze between his legs. He could be camped 5 feet from our walls with 100,000 men, said an archer wearing Cerven collars. "We'd never see a one of them through this storm." Endless, ceaseless, merciless. The snow had fallen day and night. Drifts climbed the walls and filled the crenels along the battlements. White blankets covered every roof. Tents sagged beneath the weight. Ropes were strung from hall to hall to help men keep from getting lost as they crossed the yards. Sentries crowded into the guard turrets to warm half-frozen hands over glowing braziers, leaving the wall walks to the snowy sentinels the squires had thrown up, who grew larger and stranger every night as wind and weather worked their will upon them. Ragged beards of ice grew down the spears, clasped in their snowy fists. No less a man than Hostin Frey, who had been heard growling that he did not fear a little snow, lost an ear to frostbite. The horses in the yard suffered most. The blankets thrown over them to keep them warm soaked through and froze if not changed regularly. When fires were lit to keep the cold at bay, they did more harm than good. The war horses feared the flames and fought to get away, injuring themselves and other horses as they twisted at their lines. Only the horses in the stables were safe and warm, but the stables were already overcrowded.
"The gods have turned against us,"
old Lord Locke was heard to say in the great hall.
"This is their wrath. A wind as cold as hell itself, and snows that never end. We are cursed."
"Stannis is cursed," a Dreadfort man insisted. "He is one out there in the storm." "Lord Stannis might be warmer than we know," one foolish free rider argued. "His sorceress can summon fire."
"Might be. Her red guard can melt these snows."
That was unwise. Theon knew at once. The man spoke too loudly, and in the hearing of Yellow Dick and Sir Alan and Ben Bones. When the tale reached Lord Ramsay, he sent his bastard's boys to seize the man and drag him out into the snow.
"As you seem so fond of Stannis, we will send you to him," he said.
"Daemon dance for me,
gave the free rider a few lashes with his long greased whip. Then, while Skinner and Yellow Dick made wagers on how fast his blood would freeze, Ramsay had the man dragged up to the battlement's gate. Winterfell's great main gates were closed and barred, and so choked with ice and snow that the portcullis would need to be chipped free before it could be raised. Much the same was true of the Hunter's Gate, though there at least ice was not a problem, since the gate had seen recent use. The King's Road Gate had not, and ice had frozen those drawbridge chains rock hard, which left the Battlemen's Gate, a small arched postern in the inner wall, only half a gate in truth. It had a drawbridge that spanned the frozen moat, but no corresponding gateway through the outer wall, offering access to the outer ramparts, but not the world beyond. The bleeding free rider was carried across the bridge and up the steps, still protesting. Then Skinner and Sir Alan seized his arms and legs and tossed him from the wall to the ground 80 feet below. The drifts had climbed so high that they swallowed the man bodily, but bowmen on the battlements claimed they glimpsed him sometime later, dragging a broken leg through the snow. One feathered his rump with an arrow as he wriggled away.
"He will be dead within the hour," Lord Ramsay promised.
"Or he'll be sucking Lord Stannis's cock before the sun goes down,"
Horsebane Umber threw back.
"He'd best take care it don't break off," laughed Rickard Ryswell. "Any man out there in this, his cock is frozen hard."
"Lord Stannis is lost in the storm," said Lady Dustin. "He's leagues away, dead or dying. Let winter do its worst. A few more days and the snows will bury him and his army both."
"And us as well," thought Theon, marvelling at her folly. Lady Barbary was of the north and should have known better. The old guards might be listening. Supper was peas, porridge, and yesterday's bread, and that caused muttering amongst the common men as well. Above the salt, the lords and knights were seen to be eating ham. Theon was bent over a wooden bowl, finishing the last of his own portion of peas porridge, when a light touch on his shoulder made him drop his spoon.
"Never touch me," he said, twisting down to snatch the fallen utensil off the floor before one of Ramsay's girls could get hold of it. "Never touch me."
She sat down next to him, too close, another of Abel's washerwomen. This one was young, 15 or maybe 16, with shaggy blonde hair in need of a good wash and a pair of pouty lips in need of a good kiss.
"Some girls like to touch," she said, with a little half-smile. "If it please my lord, I'm Holly."
Holly, the whore, he thought, but she was pretty enough. Once he might have laughed and pulled her into his lap. But that day was done.
"What do you want?" "To see the crypts. Where are they, my lord? Would you show me?"
Holly toyed with a strand of her hair, coiling it round her little finger.
"Deep and dark, they say. A good place for touching. All the dead kin's watching."
"Did Abel send you to me?"
"Might be. Might be I sent myself. But if it's Abel you're wanting, I could bring him. He'll sing my lord a sweet song."
Every word she said persuaded Theon that this was all some ploy.
But whose, and at what end? What could Abel want of him? The man was just a singer, a pander with a lute and a false smile.
He wants to know how I took the castle, but not to make a song of it. The answer came to him.
He wants to know how we got in, so he can get out.
Lord Bolton had Winterfell sewn up tight as a babe's swaddling clothes. No one could come or go without his leave.
He wants to flee, him and his washerwoman.
Theon could not blame him. But even so, he said, I want no part of Abel, or you, or any of your sisters. Just leave me be. Outside, the snow was swirling, dancing. Theon groped his way to the wall, then followed it to the battlement's gate. He might have taken the guards for a pair of little Walder snowmen, if he had not seen the white plumes of their breath. "I want to walk the walls," he told them, his own breath frosting in the air. "Bloody cold up there," one warned. "Bloody cold down here," the other said. "But you do as you like, turncloak." He waved Theon through the gate. The steps were snow-packed and slippery, treacherous in the dark. Once he reached the wall walk, it did not take him long to find the place where they'd thrown down the free rider. He knocked aside the wall of fresh-fallen snow, filling up the crenel, and leaned out between the merlons. "I could jump," he thought. "He lived. Why shouldn't I?" "He could jump and..."
"And what? Break a leg and die beneath the snow? Creep away to freeze to death?"
It was madness. Ramsay would hunt him down with the girls. Red Jane and Jez and Hellicent would tear him to pieces, if the guards were good. Or worse, he might be taken back alive.
"I have to remember my name," he whispered.
The next morning, Sir Aenys Frey's grizzled squire was found naked and dead of exposure in the old castle lich yard, his face so obscured by hoarfrost that he appeared to be wearing a mask. Sir Aenys put it forth that the man had drunk too much and gotten lost in the storm, though no one could explain why he had taken off his clothes to go outside. "Another drunk it," Theon thought. "Wine could drown a host of suspicions." Then, before the day was done, a crossbowman, sworn to the flints, turned up in the stables with a broken skull. "Kicked by a horse," Lord Ramsay declared. "A club, more like," Theon decided. It all seemed so familiar, like a mummer's show that he had seen before, only the mummers had changed. Roose Bolton was playing the part that Theon had played the last time round, and the dead man were playing the parts of Agar, Jinna Rednose, and Gelmar the Grim. Reek was there too, he remembered, but he was a different Reek, a Reek with bloody hands and lies dripping from his lips, sweet as honey. Reek, reek, it rhymes with sneak. The death set Roose Bolton's lords to quarrelling openly in the great hall. Some were running short of patience.
"How long must we sit here waiting for this king who never comes?" Sir Huston Frey demanded. "We should take the fight to Stannis and make an end to him."
"Leave the castle," croaked one-armed Harwood Stout. His tone suggested he would sooner have his remaining arm hacked off. "Would you have us charge blindly into the snow?"
"To fight Lord Stannis, we would first need to find him," Roose Risewell pointed out. "Our scouts go out the Hunter's Gate, but of late none of them return."
Lord Wyman Manderly slapped his massive belly.
"White Harbour does not fear to ride with you, Sir Huston. Lead us out, and my knights will ride behind you."
Sir Huston turned on the fat man. "Close enough to drive a lance through my back, aye? Where are my kin, Manderly? Tell me that. Your guests, who brought your son back to you?"
"His bones, you mean?"
Manderly speared a chunk of ham with his dagger.
"I recall them well. Rhaegar of the Round Shoulders with his glib tongue. Bold Sir Jared, so swift to draw his steel. Simon, the spymaster, always clinking coins. They brought home Wendell's bones. It was Tywin Lannister who returned Willis to me, safe and whole, as he had promised. A man of his word, Lord Tywin. Seven save his soul."
Lord Wyman popped the meat into his mouth, chewed it noisily, smacked his lips and said,
"The road has many dangers, sir. I gave your brother's guests gifts when we took our leave of White Harbour. We swore we would meet again at the wedding. Many and more bore witness to our parting."
"Oh, many and more," mocked Aenys Frey. "Or you and yours."
"What are you suggesting, Frey?"
The Lord of White Harbour wiped his mouth with his sleeve.
"I do not like your tone, sir. No, not one bloody bit.
Step out into the yard, you sack of suet, and I'll serve you all the bloody bits that you can stomach.
Sir Hustin said. Wyman Manderley laughed, but half a dozen of his knights